Welcome to week number 7 of the newsletter. And this is the podcast that's based upon that newsletter, hosted by myself, Kirby Lachrunji, and Dawn Riddler. It's the newsletter that we write on a weekly basis, full of news about economies, politics, anything that catches our eye, and quite frankly, anything that we think will shape the world in which we are living in today. We're touching on a bunch of topics this week: the UK economy, US PPI, Nvidia, if you haven't heard about that, and about how it's topped all estimates from a market cap perspective, Argentina, dollarization of that, what that means, Russia, the budget. And then I end off the piece or the newsletter this week talking about a book that was written by Lester Fenter back in 1997 called When Mandela Goes. Now, to start off this the podcast again, this is kind of where the markets were this week. S&P 500 just briefly up at 0.06%. The NASDAQ down 0.53%. That's after a very, very large run in the Magnificent Seven. The Dow Jones up 0.26%. If we go across into Europe, Eurostoxx 50 was up 1.24% for the week. And then if we look across into China, the Shanghai Index flat for the week. The China A50 flat for the week. And so was the Shanghai Index. Looking again at currencies, Rand dollar at 18.89. Remember, the budget is this week, and we're going to be looking, and Dawn is going to be doing quite a large in-depth discussion and a think piece around the budget once that gets released. 1889, Rand against the Euro, 2035, and then Great British Pound against the South African Rand at 2382. So Dawn, let's start off by, let's just briefly look at the budget. You know, not much options for government, right?
Yes, there were people expecting that maybe something would come out in SONA, but SONA's just become almost irrelevant from a policy perspective. And so it's the nuts and bolts. It's the, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road. It's the money. You know, it's where fiscal policy and is going to come into play. Now, just remember that fiscal policy broadly is taxes, and monetary policy broadly is interest rates. The budget deals with taxes, and more importantly, how the government spends it slash misspends it, perhaps.
Yeah.
The proceeds, you know, it's always interesting to see whether, you know, whether the tax proceeds have increased. Last year, they came in at about 1.2 trillion. And at the moment, I'm looking at that fairly carefully. I'm in the process of updating my piece on the National Health Insurance. And I want to see what the government is doing in terms of introducing any legislation to put some more money towards healthcare, because just diverting our medical aid receipts is not going to be enough. They are going to need in the region of circa 550 billion rand, which is little, just shy of half of the proceeds. That's just not going to happen. So the budget, I'm expecting to be populistic. It's going to, you know, give away our hard-earned taxpayers' money. You know, I think one of the things that people know about me is, don't talk to me about government money. It's not government money. It's taxpayers' money, right? And, you know, the government like to think that they're, you know, using their largesse and giving away their money. It's not their money. It's our money. It's our taxpayers' money. So I think we might just see the two-pot pension system being promulgated. That has now been delayed for 3 years now. And the FSPs and providers and that kind of thing have probably got their act together sufficiently for that two-pot pension system. That's not going to be really relevant to a lot of our listeners. But at the end of the day, it is going to make sure that pension money is preserved. Mm. And it does allow a certain amount of allowance of your previous savings in it. There are going to be effects, and you may be able to withdraw a small amount of your pension without having to actually retire from a job. This is one of the reasons a twin pot system is being put in place, mostly to stop government workers resigning from their jobs just to get their hands on the pension.
Now, if you're listening to this, Dawn does a huge amount of work around the NHI, the costing of it, what it means for you in the street, and just some of the movements around it. And I'm pretty certain Dawn is going to be another think piece that comes out post-budget on the NHI, as it will be on the budget. Watch the space. Watch. We will be publishing it. We'll be putting this out on Twitter. Go to our website. Go and have a look at that. That's rexalom.co.za, where you'll be able to find all the backdated information and on things that we've produced in the past. Dawn, this is a good time to talk about the piece that I wrote this week in the newsletter. And look, this is not a normal thing for me to write. I generally try and write about markets and so on. I think perhaps that's maybe an area that I could maybe provide more insight. But you know, in 1997, I was 24 years old and I read Lester Fenter's book, When Mandela Goes. And it went onto my bookshelf. I read it. I remember taking some of it in. I was a young guy. I was 24 years old. And South Africa was starting to go through this economic miracle. You know, they remember it was the post, it was the veneer of the post-apartheid world. So, Nelson Mandela was the poster child for that. You had celebrities flying into South Africa, trying to shake hands with Nelson Mandela, trying to set up businesses in South Africa. And all of a sudden, Lester Fenter's book came out almost as a warning that this is what South Africa could become. Let me just take you into that, because last week I took this book off my bookshelf and I read it and I read portions of it again. Let me just anecdotally just go through this. There's really three sections in the book. The first section deals with what's called rising anger. The second one is silent dynamics. It really is attitudes and behaviors of a new society, crime, corruption, that sort of thing. And then the third part is what he calls future outcomes. Now, future outcomes is really where he tells a story of a family in South Africa. The family is the Barnard family. And here are the things he writes about back in 1997. He talks about where the family moves from a suburban home into a security estate. He talks about them having to live more in a smaller dwelling because they can't afford a larger dwelling and everybody is trying to kind of hunker down. How it becomes difficult for them to leave the security environment. He talks about how the ANC tripartite alliance falls apart and how there's obviously the ensuing mess of this. He talks about ongoing power cuts. He talks, you know, in the book, he talks about how the power comes on and off for the family and how they have to kind of almost live their lives in these pockets as this happens. He talks about window washers and beggars at street corners. And by now I'm saying, is any of this familiar to us? If you're living in South Africa, kidnappings, he talks about that in the book. And it's almost as if I read this book and I looked back 24 years ago and I kind of looked at it and I said, wow, he was pretty much on the money as far as this was concerned. And pretty much it's pretty daunting reading something like this 30 years later and finding somebody being so much on the money as far as this is concerned. Now, I don't know if Lester Fenter is still with us. He ends off his book by citing the American economist Joel Stern, also deceased by now, but he visited South Africa in 1997 and he really had just three things to say. He said, as long as we have exchange controls and we have high crime rates and high taxes, you can forget about fixing South Africa. You fix those, you potentially stand a chance of fixing South Africa. And that is now the big question kind of leading into these elections and the budget and various other things. Those three things have yet to be fixed 30 years on.
Kobe, I remember 1997 fairly well. You know, I was turning 21 for the second time. But what I do remember and what I think is important, you know, obviously with age comes, you know, some longer hindsight and from a personal perspective, is that this thing about exchange controls that you mentioned. And we have spoken about it from time to time in our newsletters and in our podcasts. We are one of only, at the moment, around 35 to 37 countries in the world that still have exchange controls, right? Yep. And we are not in illustrious company. We're in the company of bad actors, Iran's, Iraq's, and Afghanistan's, and people. But Kenya, and we've spoken about this, and I'm not going to sort of harbor on the point, but Kenya during that period, and well, actually just before the sort of 1997 period, probably in the late sort of 80s into the 90s, they eventually abandoned exchange control. It had got so bad in Kenya that when you went to Kenya, you used to buy money on the black market, right? There were two parallel sort of exchange controls that went on, and you literally went into the market, or other people that had money offshore or wanted money offshore, and you know, the exchange rate, it was a rand, you know, sort of 19 to the dollar. We had exactly the same, and it was a good 25 to 50% differential between the black market and the ordinary exchange control. You know, people were prepared to give you way more shillings if you gave them hard currency. And we haven't seen that. And Kenya abandoned that a long time ago. You know, well in the 90s, by the 90s, they had abandoned exchange controls. And here we're sitting 30 years later, and we still haven't exchange controls. Listen, the real money is long gone. It's
Yeah,
long
sure.
gone. You know, why they keep harping on this, I really don't know. Yeah.
This, I suppose, is the problem. We've spoken about it. I mean, I end off the think piece by saying, and this, I suppose, is different this time around for me. And maybe it's a personal feeling, but it's different for me going into this election season. There's a lot more people saying, listen, society, stand up to this. Try and see what's happening to you. This is not a political decision. It's your decision. It's your tax money, and it's your future. You are merely trying to tick a politician into power. Perhaps try and do something about it. The Rise Mzansi movement for me has got a lot to do with it. I'm seeing them doing a lot of work trying to change people's mindsets around, listen, politics is something that happens on this side and my life happens somewhere else. Actually, the two are intertwined. You elect a politician. Try and act in such a way that you can take the country forward. I also come to the conclusion that the more the gap between the haves and the have-nots continue to widen, it becomes very difficult to find a common goal to have all South Africans get behind and have an objective to be able to take a country forward. I see different objectives. And as the haves and the have-nots continue to, that gap continues to widen, it becomes a lot more difficult to do that. So there's a golden opportunity here. There's a moment here. And I think it's important for people to take this stuff seriously and for people to in South Africa to start looking out. I also think that 30 years on, we've been through a lot. We've seen the fragmentation of South Africa in a very, very large way. Can it get worse? Yeah, absolutely it can. But I'm probably thinking if you're still here 30 years on, you probably have seen the worst. You probably have seen the worst. Maybe a little bit worse, but you've probably seen the worst.
I think the difference, as you say, was with a party like Rise Mzansi, is to try and get South Africans not to vote along racial lines. And if somebody like Rise Mzansi can do it, that's why the DA are never going to get it, because they're still seen as a lily white party. Any sort of people of color that they bring on board don't seem to stay long, however good they are. And I mean, they do try and start their own parties, but they kind of, it just doesn't work. But I think this brings us on to that sort of next topic of dollarization of a currency.
Yeah,
Now, we
Pochettino.
saw that in Zimbabwe. We watched it. It was the only thing probably that brought Zimbabwe back from the brink of 1,000,000,000% inflation that they had, was by dollarizing their economy. You know, in doing a little bit of research behind it, it's not as easy as saying one day, okay, we've now abandoned the rand. It's the US dollar from here on out. You will get a certain amount of black market trading and this going
Activity,
on. But,
sure.
you know, one of the issues, and I know that Argentina are just flirting with it at this point in time, haven't actually committed to it. You do require reserves, foreign reserves, in order to be able to do that. Or somebody who will prop up those foreign reserves. Obviously, that is what happened
Absolutely.
in Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe, it wasn't just a dollarization, it was a randization as well, because the rand, as well as the dollar, and to all intents and purposes, continue to do so. Every time they try and get off it, they can't work. But I think it's very interesting to watch how some of these radical things, the Milei is having to talk about and think about, and they're going to be deeply unpopular.
Absolutely.
Dollarization could result in run on the bank and
Yeah, absolutely.
cause chaos. So, but he's having to think about it because now their inflation is now still at 200% and rising. He has to do something before they default on their bonds, which they may still do.
Yeah, I mean, Dawn, to your point, I mean, you want to do something, a country wants to do something like this. The first thing that you need is you need those reserves, because if you think about it, your whole banking system is reliant on a specific currency and its exchange rate and everything else that happens. So your reserves have to be large enough so that the day that you start doing this, the banks can easily swap their local currency for US dollars. so that they can dollarize themselves rather than creating this vacuum. Because the day you announce this, your local currency's value is literally just going to plummet relative to the US dollar because everybody's going to try and sell it. So you almost have to say, okay, we're going to be doing this, but you have the opportunity for a month or two or three or whatever it is to swap all your local currency at this rate for US dollars. And it's picked as of today. And for that, you need reserves. Now, interesting, you do this as a country. It's interesting because in Argentina, the inflation rate, as you've written this week, is over 200%. So if you've got that kind of or appreciation, shall I rather say, of goods and services, and you just cannot keep with it, well, you're going to look at that and say, well, I'd welcome having US dollars in this economy. Quite frankly, it's fine. Let's take a bit of pain. Let's get to dollars. And then at least I've got more of a stable way of understanding the world in which we operate. And at least I can make better decisions for my business. The nice thing is that if you do this as a country, you get away from the cost of actually running a central bank, running a treasury where you've got to worry about money supply and all of those things. All of those things, you literally go by the wayside because you now have become a dollarized economy. You're part of the international economy. And why wouldn't you want to do that? I always look at emerging market currencies and the myriad of them that are out there. And yes, it's national pride and all of those good things. But perhaps they go the way of airlines. You know, it was also a national pride thing to have an airline back in the 1960s and 1970s. But with the advent of cryptocurrency, blockchain, all of those kind of things, perhaps maybe in the future, people look at their currency and say, why do I need this? I don't need this thing, man. Let's dollarize the whole thing or whatever they decide to do.
Yeah, I agree with you, Kobe. I think especially as we become more digital, and I mean, I very rarely carry cash around with me, for example. And I mean, I haven't had a checkbook in 20 plus years, but I very rarely carry cash around with me. And even, I mean, I had to go to Home Affairs recently. They will not accept cash. It has to be digital. And, that sort of pride and everything else. I mean, all the money becomes is an R and on your bank account as opposed to a dollar sign at the end of the day, because you're not physically holding, the sort of greenback or whatever else it is.
And look, as Argentina makes these changes, if you were trying to spend money in an emerging market, where are you going to spend that? If Argentina has gone through these kind of reforms, India has gone through reforms, how does South Africa stack up on the stage, on the world stage, against some of these countries? They don't. They ideologically dinosaurs. They continue to hunker after something which is the National Democratic Revolution, which really speaking is just a mess at the end of the day. And next to countries which are now really putting a unique selling proposition together, it becomes difficult to start to convince people to put money into South Africa. By the way, the other thing that Lester Fenter predicts is Western Cape will become the hub. It'll become a lot more prosperous than other parts of the country. How's that for foresight, right? So anything that Lester Fenter now says, I don't know if he's still alive, but I mean, anything that Lester Fenter said, perhaps we should be listening.
One of the other things that I came across this week, which I found really interesting, taxpaying South Africans mostly, people who actually go out there and earn a living and try to make a life here. There's a lot of cocooning going on. You sort of isolate yourself from all of those things that Lester Fenter was talking about, from the crime, from the load shedding, from the water shedding and all of those kind of things.
Yes.
For as long as you can, you sort of cocoon yourself from all of that until you can't anymore. But by that time, the world has moved in such a direction that there are not a lot of jobs that can't be sort of run remotely. You can take your manufacturing plant and move it to India. So even the bricks and mortars things can be outside. Amazon are imminently about to launch in South Africa. I was on the radio again last week. We were discussing this. And, we were discussing Shein and Temu and, these big global importers and exporters and how this is changing the landscape in South Africa and the sort of competition that you expect from people like that take a lot again to get from Amazon. And of course, the big differential with Amazon, and I don't know whether you've ever joined Amazon Prime yourself, but with Amazon Prime, where you get free next day deliveries and all of those kind of things, you get some very nice content on from a, you know, an entertainment perspective. So, I mean, it's an added extra that there are lots of South Africans already have Prime. It's not terribly expensive. Certainly considerably cheaper than DStv, and it's going to be an interesting space to watch, you know, whether they manage to make a go of it. When they launched in Australia, they had some stiff competition, much stiffer than the competition that we've got here. But within 5 years, they've now got the significant market share.
And that just shows you. I mean, it shows you power of idea, the power of branding. And look, DStv has and MultiChoice have, you know, they've had a fabulous run in South Africa for decades, just because they were the first on the block. But the technology is now old. You know, the method of delivery is old. Everything is just archaic, and very difficult to try and, you know, turn that around. Very difficult to try and understand that. But it's an interesting study in how one builds a moat around a business, how one defends that, and how one potentially, you know, and how one potentially exploits that. I wrote about that last week when I looked at PayPal versus Visa and MasterCard and the moats that they've actually set up around those businesses and how difficult it is to penetrate those for a business like PayPal, even though they're in the digital space and they actually create slightly different service to the traditional Visa and MasterCard service.
You know, ha having said that, and having spent time in retail, I think from a retailer's perspective, when you understand how high the fees are with Visa and MasterCard, they would readily welcome some kind of competition in this. And maybe Bitcoin in time is where it'll come. But, you know, for every card transaction, you know, you and I as consumers don't see it, but as a small business are having to pay around 2-3% of each and every transaction. Yes, it's now built into the system, so it's no longer inflationary, but you know, make no mistake, they make money hand over fist.
Oh yeah, and it's the same with Apple, right? I mean, the App Store charges a massive margin. If you want to launch your app on the App Store and you've got subscriptions coming off, they take a large chunk of that. That's what makes Apple as profitable as they really are, and why most of that money just continues to drop to the bottom line. It's a sign of a brilliant business and a brilliant business idea, but hard going, right? I mean, some of those businesses are built with hard yards, you know, to try and get it to that, you know, to that level and that point, you know.
But you know, Apple are coming up against resistance to that model. Just not just Apple, but Play Store as well, which is all, you know, as big as Apple is. For example, if you are a Kindle user, which you know I've been for decades now, you can no longer buy your books with a one click. Using your Kindle app for this exact reason, because they were wanting to take a huge chunk of that income for basically doing nothing. So, to all intents and purposes, now the Play Store and the Apple Store are just storefronts. And if you want to go and, you know, get Kindle stuff, then you actually have to leave that and go into a separate app. It's an evolving thing. I mean, look, obviously the big retailers don't do that. You know, they've got the app. And it's a free app, but you know, Apple and Play Store can't take a chunk of, you know, can't say, okay, we're going to go and take 20% of everything that is ordered on your platform. You know, the entire store would collapse because all the retailers just, yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, these are companies that have been built through, you know, years and years and years of decades of development, understanding of consumer habits, you know, how to build a product for it. And then they happen to be able to create something out of it. And to defend it is incredibly difficult. I mean, Apple at the end of the day is a consumer business. They have to come up with a handset that everybody wants. They've got to come up with a handset that is ahead of the competition and that continues to be cutting edge. You know, and then they've got to sell these things. Now, a lot of that is encapsulated globally in cell phone contracts that just renew and you get your new handset, and that's wonderful. But in order to have that happen, they need to make sure that they're ahead of the technological curve all the time. So, and that's where they're spending their money, to try and make sure that they continue to be that, because they know that if they fail there, then the rest of it is just literally going to fall apart. And that's a business for you at the end of the day. You know, I suppose we're all doing that, you know, in business on a daily basis. Well, with that being said, that's the end of our newsletter. We've basically run out of time. Head over to the newsletter. Go and have a read. If there's anything that interests you, let us know and we're happy to engage. Thanks for listening.